I want to talk about the issue of the solar dynamo, which is a very controversial subject and requires lots of more attention in the years to come with upcoming computer power. The main problem that we want to address, of course, is the question of how come we have this very systematic magnetic field behavior, both in space, north-south and east-west orientation, opposite on the other hemisphere, in space, and also in time, as you see from a butterfly diagram, where we have reversals of the magnetic field every 11 years and a migration of the magnetic field towards the equator. Highly systematic behavior, yet the underlying mechanism, as is already transparent from the magnetograms here, are extremely irregular and involving lots of small scales. Suggesting, therefore, that what is going on here is maybe a collective behavior rather than something of a non-statistical nature.
But these small scales are not irregular.
The small scales, which you see here, they show systematic behavior, and of course, in the sense that they have a certain orientation, and the underlying interpretation, of course, is a large-scale toroidal magnetic field. So there is.
I think the observers would be very upset if you call this just random.
Yeah, but of course, the magnetic field that we see here. We must explain, of course, how come it arranges in such a way that that you have systematically the same orientation, black-white, and 11 years later in the other direction. Clearly, we have this systematic behavior, but on small scale. And I think that's really what I want to say, that we have small scale behavior, and that is suggestive of arranging somehow, for one reason or the other, in a systematic way, such that we actually see this global behavior with 11-year cyclic behavior. Now, I guess the dividing line would be roundabout 50 megameters. So maybe 50 megameters is the largest of the small scales, and everything larger than 50 megameter would clearly be classified as large scale. So same things like so one of the things that we see, of course, look again at the you see that here, for example, you see systematic behavior over a range in latitude which covers almost 500 megameters. And so that's the large scale that I'm talking about. It's almost as large as the radius of the sun in latitude here, however. And small scales would be anything on the scale of this and smaller.
You call that disorder, the small scale.
Yeah.
But it's ordered. It's scaled very well.
Yeah, but of course, if you look at smaller, these are the signatures of something which is undergoing in further down, of course. And so what we see is, or believe that we see, is a large-scale toroidal magnetic field. I'm not saying that that is random. I'm saying there is a large-scale magnetic field. The question is, why is this large-scale magnetic field there, and why does it reverse after 11 years?
Yeah, the question I think is really whether the large-scale field is the result of this.
Yes,
these
indeed.
Rings, or whether the active rings are the result of the large-scale field. Now, the fact that they
no, no. They, I mean, both. I think it's quite clear that they both interplay somehow. The you need the small scales to drive the larger scales, and you need the and vice versa. And that would be what we all believe so far. And I don't think there is any alternative offered so far, as far as that is concerned. What? There's a what? No, let me know. the alternatives that are being suggested, they range, of course, from the fact that the orbital period of the Jupiter is 11 years down to other more dramatic things. And the question is, how should we possibly approach this problem? So the way how it has been approached over the last 40 years is in terms of mean field description. All I wanted to say here is that the reason why mean field subscription is offering itself is because we see lots of small-scale structures here, which all, one way or the other, seem to arrange themselves such that a large-scale magnetic field is emerging.
Is can I just get this absolutely clear? You're calling a sunspot a small scale thing? Or an active region? You're calling that small scale?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Another example of a large-scale behavior is coming up with numerical simulations. Here, just another example of a simulation of accretion disks, which I don't want to go into detail here. But again, you see a simulation which is turbulent and shows systematic behavior in time, where you see variations and reversals of the magnetic field. The question is, in this case, also in the case of numerical simulations, whenever they will become available. And I'm not saying we should not do that, of course. The question is, how can we possibly understand that? A similar question has, of course, already arisen in the context of the differential rotation of the sun. The question is, how can we have differential rotation in the sun where the equator moves faster or rotates faster than the polar regions? The standard explanation over the last decades clearly was that it has to do with Reynolds stresses. But on the other hand, there are departures from the Taylor-Proudhon theorem, and these departures are so far only explained by significant contributions from the baroclinic term. And now, in the meantime, of course, numerical simulations have come up and are showing us that differential rotation really does work. And the question is, how do we interpret these things? And typically, the interpretation is in terms of the models that have been the analytic models that have been developed in the past, which includes a mean field description of differential rotation in terms of Reynolds stresses.
What did you say was
the baroclinic term? The baroclinic term is the reason why you have departures from the Taylor-Proudhon theorem. If the baroclinic term is zero, the omega contours are perfectly vertical in the limit of rapid rotation. If the baroclinic term, which means grad T cross grad S, is finite, and there's good reasons that it should be there, and we even know from theory which direction it should have, then that we know should turn the omega contours more radial. Whether they are really doing that in practice is, of course, another question, but the tendency is at least in the right direction.
But the Reynolds stresses themselves, if you leave them out there, you also get the problem.
Yeah, you are probably saying that the Reynolds stresses themselves are quenched by the rotation.
No, I'm saying that in this interpretation that you're giving now, they cannot be a very important ingredient.
The Reynolds stresses are important. No, the Reynolds stresses. The Reynolds stresses, they are important because they provide the differential rotation per se. The question is what contributes to the shape of the differential rotation. Why is the differential rotation not vertical, but why is it more cylindrical? I'm saying the reason why that is the case is not because of the baroclinic term. It could, in principle, happen also due to the Reynolds stresses, but that's unlikely because the Taylor-Proudhon theorem is so much more effective.
Yeah, but couldn't you have differential rotation also without the Reynolds stress, just by steady state under a black baroclinic force?
In principle, yes, but the effect would be far too weak.
The order of magnitude of the turbulent diffusivity, we know that. And if you compare that to the order of magnitude of differential rotation, the two terms, incomparable unless there is practically zero derivative along the axis.
What you should ask, of course, is whether Mark Misch would agree with any of that. And you have done the simulation, so what do you see? What do you learn? I mean, how do you interpret your simulation?
Yeah, there certainly is the departure from Taylor-Proudhon is largely due to a baroclinic term.
The departure, yes, exactly. So that was what I'm saying. And the main reason for the very fact that there is differential rotation is?
I was just going to say, at least in the lower convections, at the top, we're not sure what exactly is going on.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That cannot be because without Reynolds stress, you also get pure Taylor-Proudhon rotation.
No, then you get, you get uniform rotation, but with a... If you only have the this term, you get a differential rotation which may depart from vertical, but the amount over of the differential rotation is very small.
Right.
So the amount, the delta omega itself, is determined by the Reynolds stresses. So Mark agrees, all I'm saying here is, once we have numerical simulations, we need somehow a handle in order to interpret these things. it's not sufficient to say that with global simulations we'll eventually just have the solution. We still want to interpret this. An example of this was the accretion disk simulation as one example. Another example is the Karlsruhe Dynamo experiment, which some of you may know consists of an array of swirling flows, which resemble basically the Roberts flow. And it was thought when they constructed this as being a model for the Earth's dynamo. And it was an experiment, that was a theory which was offered by Busse in the late 70s. And superficially thinking, of course, you would expect then an Earth magnetic field, which is a dipole along the axis, more or less. And pretty soon, mean field theory came along, and it was realized that if you wanted to describe this with an alpha effect, and it turned out to be a reasonable thing to do, then it would, the alpha effect would be highly anisotropic. And one prediction from such a theory was that you don't have a dipole in along the vertical axis, but in the perpendicular axis. So you have a so-called S1 field, an inclined dipole in the lying in the plane. So in that sense, again, mean field theory actually proved to be useful. And in this particular case, which was far simpler, of course, than the solar case, it actually was even pretty accurate on the level of 10% or more accurate even. The departures from a mismatch is extremely useful, of course, to understand further. The other example I was mentioning about accretion disk simulations so far was that, here we are able to produce different simulations with different boundary conditions. And you can then ask the question, how do the mean field simulations respond to changing boundary conditions? And there's one example, which I think is useful to keep in mind here, where if we take a magnetic field condition which is vertical on the disk boundary, in the top and bottom, you get an oscillatory, even parity magnetic field. But if you change this boundary condition to a perfectly conducting boundary condition, according to mean field theory, you would expect a steady dipolar field of odd parity. Then you run your simulation, which is much more expensive and takes you a few weeks. This simple calculation takes you only a few minutes. And in fact, it turned out that the prediction was actually satisfied. You get a steady, non-oscillatory magnetic field of the opposite parity. So mean field theory can, and that's how I think about this, if the mean field theory is actually good and correct, can be used to make some predictions. But of course, we must make sure it actually works correctly. The reason why we want to use it for the sun is simply because, as far as I was arguing, we seem to see collective behavior in the sun.
Axel?
Yes.
For motivation, of course, we observe mean field. And isn't it a good motivation for mean field theory?
That's what I wanted to say, yeah. So, for those of you who haven't seen that before, mean field theory means really just that you average the induction equation. If you do that, there's one nonlinear term which comes from U cross B, where you keep the contributions from the mean velocity and magnetic fields, but you also have the contributions from the unresolved small-scale magnetic field, unresolved in the respect in the framework of mean fields. And then this has to be expressed in terms of large-scale quantities, and mean field theory has shown that it has, in isotropic simple conditions, this form. This corresponds to a renormalized current with a turbulent magnetic diffusivity, and here's an alpha effect which corresponds, which we know is only present under if a mirror symmetry is violated, for example. So there are many conditions which do not apply to the sun where alpha would vanish for symmetry reasons. Because of this property, this alpha must be related to a pseudoscalar, and one of these pseudoscalars is, of course, the current, the velocity, the helicity of the velocity field, of the flow field. And that's a standard theory which has been developed long ago. And basically, the alpha effect corresponds to swirling of these magnetic field lines in that direction. And cartoon pictures help you understanding why that can actually lead to the migration. Now, there have been serious problems addressed and discussed over the last 10 years, mostly started by Fausto and Samuel Weinstein, and many other colleagues have contributed to this. The first issue was that the turbulent diffusivity, which is clearly important in this issue because it has to do with the timescale of the 11-year cycle, that this effect was actually found to be catastrophically quenched, which means that, and the same is true for alpha, which means that the alpha effect is not only just the kinematic value, but it's decreased as the magnetic field strength B increases relative to the equipartition field strength, which has to do with the kinetic energy of the motions. And the most worrying thing here is that there's a large factor in between, which is the magnetic Reynolds number. So if that really applies, then you find, of course, that if you have a large magnetic Reynolds number, say 10 to the 8th or 10 to the 9th, that then the alpha effect would already be quenched if the magnetic field has a small fraction of the equipartition field strength. In fact, what we observe is a mean magnetic field which is perhaps more in the order of up to 10 kilogauss at the bottom of the convection zone, and which is basically equipartition value, and not four orders of magnitude less.
If this ansatz is correct,
yes,
which this forces assume, right?
I'm sorry.
You assume that this ansatz is correct.
You mean
was never derived.
I assume that it
is. That is formula.
Okay, the way, so what is not derived is that the thing we can derive with certain degree of rigor is that the turbulent diffusivity in two dimensions is quenched. That one you can derive to your heart
symptoms. Yes, but not in three.
In three dimensions, I don't think one can derive anything at all to do with the turbulent diffusivity. I mean, the turbulent diffusivity in three dimensions is really hard to get a grip on.
Right.
In three dimensions, there are results that can be derived concerning alpha subject to certain closure assumptions. So the results are about as good as the closures are. And closures in MHD are dangerous and not to be trusted, nor are the results. So
yes, I agree. So
when Savon and I wrote basically that formula down, we wrote it as an analogy with what was going on in two dimensions for diffusion. And we said, you know, if the same kind of intuitive processes that limit the diffusion in two dimensions apply to three dimensions to the alpha effect, this is what would happen. What made
okay.
us much more confident that we were not just way out in the left field is that if you set up reasonable numerical simulation with moderate magnetic Reynolds number and check that formula, basically you find results that are consistent with that formula and inconsistent with the formula that doesn't have.
Just to shoot a little bit ahead of time here, one thing you could, in principle, not.
What's going on?
One thing one can, in principle, not exclude is a formula that has been offered by Grusenov and Diamond, and also by Clarin and Rozmaikin and Rogachevsky, is a formula which actually looks very much the same. So there's the Reynolds factor in front of this times the large-scale magnetic field divided by the equipartition. But there's not simply just the alpha kinetic or alpha naught up here, but there's another term, and this extra term is an eta turbulent multiplied by the magnetic Reynolds number again, multiplied by the current helicity, divided by B, the equipartition field strength. So what I'm saying is this formula has been actually offered, and I'm coming to this later on, in the literature. And of course, in the experiments that have been carried out so far, the mean magnetic field was defined as an average over the entire box, in which case J is clearly zero. And these are the large-scale fields here. These are large-scale fields. Over bars indicate large-scale fields. So, of course, if a formula of this form is verified numerically, it does not exclude that the real formula could actually be more complicated, like in this form. So you would not be able to exclude that based on the experiments that you have done so far. So, forward and backward. So the question clearly was, what is wrong? I said already, in this case, the mean magnetic field is a uniform magnetic field. It's even worse because it's applied. So it is not actually the result of dynamo action, but it's actually an applied magnetic field. The reason why that could really potentially go wrong is basically just in view of this formula here, where the magnetic field should perhaps be allowed to be variable in space.
That formula over there contains that thing over there as a subcase. So if that formula is right, the other one's the
one. Absolutely, absolutely. The question
it's
is...
It's not a matter of what's wrong. I mean, there's nothing wrong. If that's right,
so, correct.
That's the other one.
So if... but do you know what the consequence of this formula is?
But if you have a situation that is incompatible,
I will show you that this formula actually, and it has been shown in the paper by Rosmaikin and colleagues, that this formula again is actually a subset of yet another formula, and this formula is actually a time-dependent formula. And what I'm going to argue later on, but for the time being I won't go into mean field theory, only towards the end. What I'm going to argue is that the numerical evidence that we have so far is in support of the time-dependent equation, of which this particular equation pops out as the stationary limit. So whenever we are interested in time-dependent phenomena, like phenomena that happen on timescales longer than the resistive, shorter than the resistive timescale, that's clearly the case for the sun, we of course have to have the dynamical formula. And the dynamical formula shows different behavior again than the stationary limit, which this one is. And only of this limit, certain subcases have been addressed so far. In conclusion, there's no conflict with anything that has been shown today, but there is likewise still scope for alternatives, which of course we have to understand. If for the next transparencies, and I think these are up to 17 transparencies. The majority of the transparencies, I'm not going to talk about mean field theory. The mean field theory is really the interpretation of the numerical simulations that I'm going to present. The numerical simulations are based on weakly compressible isotropic turbulence, which is driven by an explicit forcing term, which consists of helically polarized waves. And the induction equation is written in the uncurled form to make sure that the magnetic field is solenoidal. Lorentz force and other things are included. So here we see, again not in optimum quality, one of the results that we have in this case. What I'm showing here is two things. On the one hand, we see is power spectrum, wave number, and the power. The black line is the magnetic power spectrum. The dotted line is the kinetic energy spectrum. And the dashed line is the magnetic helicity spectrum multiplied by 1/2 and divided by the wave number k. And it's only the modulus which is taken, and this curve should be always below the magnetic energy curve, which you see is indeed the case. In order to see the sign of the magnetic helicity, it's a sign quantity, the sign is indicated by a color. So here you see throughout most of the spectrum in the final state, the magnetic helicity has positive helicity, which is the same helicity of the forcing. If you want to apply this to the sun, for example, we believe that the current helicity, which corresponds to the forcing, the kinetic helicity, which corresponds to the forcing, is negative in the northern hemisphere. And then you would have, if this was to be applied to the sun, of course, would be negative throughout most of it, and then on large scales you would have opposite helicity.
The large scale field goes all the way to partition?
The large scale field goes actually to a super-equipartition. Mm-hmm. So the magnetic energy reaches five times the equipartition value. Super-equipartition in this case. It's not sufficient to look just at the spectra, it's always useful to look at the spatial signal. And here we see that the magnetic field has actually arranged in such a form that in two planes, here we see Bx, By, Bz, that in two of these planes, there's a systematic component of the magnetic field which shows you a sinusoidal variation. You should think of this as a magnetic field which has a large-scale component which is of Beltrami type, which means one component is cosinusoidal, the other one is sinusoidal, phase-shifted by 90 degrees. So clearly the current, of course, in the simulation is finite. And in fact, the J dot B term is maximum.
You said this was helically forced.
Yeah.
Was that in that previous U graph?
It did say helically. Yes, it did say here. Polarized. So basically, you can every vector field can be written in a non-rotational component, irrotational, and rotational component. The rotational component can be split again into positively and negatively polarized waves. And the forcing then is chosen from these particular realizations, and only one of the polarization is taken into account.
What do you mean by waves? Is this a sound wave or?
It's a wave-like forcing which is changing randomly every time step. So it's delta correlated in time the forcing. The velocity is of course not delta correlated.
F is random function of time,
yeah.
Times cosine.
That's right. Yeah. I should actually point out that. The particular details of this forcing do not seem to be crucial here if you use forcing which is calculated as a random signal in space, which has different properties. But it's helical, or it's made helical, you find, again, similar behavior.
One wave number, or is it
It's basically at one peak, yeah. So it's between 4.5 and 5.5 in this particular case. So it's a relatively narrow band in wave number space. So one of these things you see is super equipartition of the large scales. Here you see a little bit of what is supposed or would become an inertial range if you had larger resolution. This is already the diffusion range. Now, different. Oh, the Prandtl number was a unity in the previous case. And you have seen, of course, that both magnetic and kinetic energy were in full equipartition at small scales. Or at all the energy carrying scales. Now I'm showing you a calculation with a large Prandtl number, which is achieved here by having a very small kinetic Reynolds number. So we have basically a forcing ray in the diffusive range.
Mu m to me, what's the definition of Prandtl number?
A large Prandtl number means that the magnetic Reynolds number is large and the
magnetic
kinetic Reynolds number is very small. Mm-hmm. The reason why I'm showing you this is. Because you will see something which appears to be very odd. So you see here, due to dynamo action, the magnetic field has risen from a very small seed magnetic field up to this point when I stopped the simulation here. You see that at this time still most of the magnetic energy is at smallish scales, clearly scales smaller than the energy carrying scale, which would be basically over here. So the magnetic energy is basically peaking at smaller scales. Which was then taken as reason enough to believe that the large-scale dynamo process is basically suppressed. So you would saturate at this point somewhere, and then at large scales, the magnetic field would not grow any further. Now let's then see what happens. The magnetic field rises further. It's still strongly peaked at small scales. And now the magnetic field begins to come to a halt at the small scales over here. It's still a very small scale. You don't see anything. So if kinematic mean field dynamo theory was of any use, clearly that must be almost useless because you don't see any large scale pattern as such. There is really no large scale field as yet. Now look a little bit further. You see a few such large scale patches here, but most of the energy is now actually still at wave number of 2, and so you're not yet at the energy of wave number 1. And it takes a very long time until the magnetic energy actually increases at the wave number 1 to the final equipartition value. So you do actually reach the final equipartition value. You do reach very strong fields, but after only a long time.
Can we check that F doesn't have any large-scale component?
F?
Forcing. Doesn't it? Forcing.
Yeah, the forcing. You see that actually even in the kinetic velocity spectrum. The
forcing
kinetic
is not large-scale, right?
That's right. It's not large-scale. So the kinetic energy spectrum shows no power at large scales.
Can you explain why your results are different to, say, Steve Cowell's results at high magnetic Prandtl number where he finds it very hard to cascade?
Oh, first of all, he talks actually about an inverse cascade when he doesn't even have helicity in the forcing. So he talks a different language, basically. He calls it an inverse cascade, something which could generate large-scale field even by diffusion, and then he says it's not there. That's basically what it is. There are other calculations by Marone recently who finds confirming results at, however, small resolution so far only, and he goes further to investigate what happens if he takes fractional magnetic helicities or fractional helicities in the forcing, and he finds a cutoff value below a certain fraction, the large-scale field generation stops working. And I think that's simply explained by a cutoff in the effective dynamo number. If you are below a certain number, you wouldn't expect that. He finds this threshold at 50%. I also find such a threshold, but it's actually below 10% in my calculation so far.
How long does it take to develop this large
load? We come to that. It's a resistive time scale. The resistive time scale. The first question is, what is the cause of the large scale field? Two perhaps different alternatives have been offered.
You didn't have initial large scale field?
There was no initial large scale field. But you always get, of course, a projection.
You get,
of course, a projection onto k equals 1 simply from the random power spectrum.
Okay.
There's the inverse cascade, which has been proposed by Frisch and Bouquet in the 70s. This is an appealing mechanism because it's intrinsically nonlinear. So if you are worried about the limitations of a linear theory, then this should basically be all right, you would think. The other competitor is the alpha effect, which is an intrinsically linear theory, except for modifications built upon afterwards. One of the differences appears to be that the alpha effect is a non-local phenomenon in k-space, whereas the inverse cascade, you would think, is a local phenomenon whereby energy and magnetic helicity in particular is transferred from progressively into progressively larger scales. One way of actually seeing this in action is the following. I take here a simulation with an extremely large scale separation. The problem so far was I was forcing a wave number of 5, and there wasn't hardly any room between the wave number 5 and the system size, so it's a finite size effect. Now I'm taking the opposite approach of forcing actually very much within the diffusion range here. This is the wave number of the forcing, and you see here, already in the kinematic regime, a secondary peak, which pops up. And this secondary peak needs to be explained, first of all. Let's look at this once more. You will see that in the early stages, when the field is weak, the kinematic peak actually does not change position. It stays at the same position all the time, and it just grows in amplitude until equipartition is reached, and then the peak travels to the left. So we see this funny phenomenon of this peak here, and the fact that it's not propagating, or that first of all that it's there, is actually directly explained by an alpha effect. If you do have an alpha effect, you would expect a maximum growth rate at a wave number k max here, which is given by alpha divided by twice the turbulent magnetic diffusivity, total one. And you would expect this to be at a wave number of approximately half the wave number of the forcing, which is right around here at this wave number. And that's indeed consistent with the simulations. So one of the predictions clearly does seem to be satisfied in the simulation here. So you see growth at one particular wave number first, but then the peak actually begins to propagate to the left. And that, again, is very easy to explain if, as we all expect, alpha is eventually quenched. If alpha becomes quenched, k would decrease, and that's what we see. K decreases
in larger scales.
You can perhaps call this an inverse cascade. The reason why other people don't like to call it an inverse cascade is because it's really just a bump which travels through. There's no sustained flux. There's no sustained flux as in ordinary Kolmogorov turbulence, where you have a forward.
Isn't it also true that in the simulation, if you sit there and you work out like the magnetic Reynolds number, the Reynolds number, whatever you want to work out, this is like laminar,
that's right.
Laminar, laminar, this thing like these nonlinear interactions in the simulations are a tiny perturbation on this incredibly diffusive process.
So
most people wouldn't go in with the inverse cascade machinery because simply you're not looking at...
Okay, but I'm coming to an issue which has to do with the resistive timescale of the whole large-scale field that is being generated, which is very, very general and has even nothing to do with the turbulence. And I'm coming to that in just a moment. Before I do that, let me first point out that the simulations are actually converged as far as spectral resolution is concerned. As you increase resolution, as Foster was alluding to, you do see, of course, changes in the simulations. In particular, you see the gradual buildup of what appears to be something like an inertial subrange, which is clearly very short here, but you would expect, and you do see the evidence for that, that it just becomes longer. But at large scales, which is important here, because we are interested in large scales, you see absolute full convergence. The spectra are therefore okay even at 30, at a 30 cubed resolution for minor departures.
What's the difference between those runs?
The magnetic Reynolds number was different. It was increased. And the same here. As you go from run 1 to run 3, both the magnetic and the kinetic Reynolds number is increased. So the Prandtl number in all these three runs is unity, actually.
But what is the Reynolds number?
That depends how you want to define it, I think we come to that in a moment. As far as the mixing of the mixing property is concerned, it goes up to 40. So if you take a passive scalar and you ask the question, how quickly is a passive scalar being mixed? It's mixed 40 times faster than by the molecular diffusion that is in the code. So in that sense, you could say it's a Reynolds number of up to 40. The other thing you see is
the biggest
Reynolds number, or magnetic, 40 in that sense. So as far as mixing property is concerned, it's 40. As I emphasize again, as far as the time scale is concerned, that is actually not an issue because the way how I explained that has to do with magnetic helicity conservation, and in that case, no turbulent magnetic diffusivities actually enter that theory. Enter that equation. Okay, you see that as the Reynolds number increases, the growth rate begins to approach a fast dynamical growth rate. So you have an exponential increase of the magnetic energy, and then you have an equipartition, a saturation phase. What you hardly begin to see here is that the saturation phase isn't actually completed by the time the large magnetic energy reaches equipartition, which is equal to the kinetic energy, which is given here as a dotted line. There's a very prolonged saturation phase, which you see more clearly in a plot like this, where I'm showing the linear magnetic energy on a linear scale as a function of time. These times are actually sound travel times, and the turnover times are a third or a fourth of that. So that means many, many turnover times. And you see here that in small resolution runs, the saturation happens almost instantaneously. Once the magnetic energy has become comparable to the equipartition energy, it reaches a certain equipartition value, and then it stays there put. If you go to larger Reynolds numbers, you say basically the same thing, except if you go to much larger Reynolds numbers, this is run 3 here, you see that it really takes a very long time until you have full saturation. You may not even believe that at first when you see that first, but you finally begin to see that there is a problem with your calculation, because if you go to even very larger Reynolds numbers, like in this case with the magnetic Prandtl number of 100, you haven't even reached equipartition at all. That does not mean that you have to run for longer. The first thing it means is you have to understand what's actually going on.
Does it look like opposite to simple formula of quenching? You increase the Reynolds number and your level.
The first problem with a simple theory like this is that you do reach very strong magnetic field strength. And so that means that the coefficient in front of here cannot be the magnetic Reynolds number. It must be of order unity, or even less, in order to get super equipartition. On the other hand...
But that formula there, I mean, insofar as we ever wrote down that formula to make sense, it was to address one problem, which is AK, the one that you call alpha K over there, is the turbulent form. It's not anything else.
Yeah, what's the problem with that? That would be...
Alpha K.
I know exactly what this value ought to be.
Turbulent value.
It's 40.
So if it's turbulent, it means that alpha K has to be of order U, the RMS velocity. No one has ever argued, or at least it shouldn't have argued, that you cannot have an alpha effect that it's of order something else and has to do with collisional processes. I mean, that's not the
theories
are about. So what happens to the system on a time scale? As you say, if the magnetic Reynolds number over there is 40, by the time you got up to 1500 or 1600, you're looking at a process that has taken many ohmic diffusions.
Sure.
It has nothing to do whatsoever with the question of whether or not a turbulent process is going on.
Now this
the turbulent process is the one that occurs on order.
No, wait a moment. I think you're jumping too fast here. It is true that you have a resistive time scale in the problem.
Right.
The question is...
So what you're seeing in all those simulations, besides, you know...
The question is...
...an ohmic process, which is not at all what any of those formulas were supposed to address.
But the important question is, first of all, to get the to describe this correctly. If the mean field theory, and it of course does generate, you see a large scale magnetic field here. If that is correct, the mean field theory obviously was wrong, as you would see.
So the question is, what is? Not have mentioned our papers at the beginning, which you did.
Well, the question
because
is what
our papers have all to do with the question of whether or not you can maintain a turbulent process over the one field. That's it. I mean, so.
Yeah, but here you see a large scale magnetic field which is in strong superfree partition.
That's fine. It's just that I'm
not. No, it's
not. With the question that you formulated at the beginning.
No.
I mean, what you're dealing with now is laminar ohmic processes. With a little bit of a random perturbation, which is a very interesting field, which should definitely be studied, but it's got nothing to do with.
Let me repeat again. I'm talking about a mixing property which is 40. If I call this a laminar process, that is first of all not justified. If something diffuses 40 times faster than laminar, why should I call it a laminar process? The second thing is, it is absolutely not the reason why you have this resistive behavior. The resistive behavior has to do with magnetic helicity conservation and nothing else. In magnetic helicity conservation, this property doesn't actually enter. Magnetic helicity equation in a closed box, which is all we are talking about here at the moment, simply states that the magnetic helicity A dot B, A is the magnetic vector potential, evolves proportional to the current helicity. And there's no other term. And that is actually, there's one coefficient in front of this, which is the ohmic diffusion time. So if anything really happens slowly in the system, it is the magnetic helicity. In this equation, there's no mentioning whatsoever of any of the velocities, the small-scale velocity or the large-scale velocity.
Okay, then I have a question. Take that equation as you've written and ask yourself that question. If you observe, I mean physically, you sit there and you observe, I mean that equation over there is telling you that if E is equal to zero, the helicity is conserved exactly.
Correct.
So, suppose that you have a system, you have no idea what the hell is going on. All you know is that the rate of change of the helicity is of order 1 in turnover time. And this is true in the limit in which eta is going to zero. It means that you're violating the conservation of a quantity that should be conserved at order 1 time. So the conclusion is that something has to be diverging like crazy. Now put back the equation.
I wanted to show you this curve here. You're saying...
No, I'm saying what I'm saying. I'm saying it right, I think. So conclusion is that if that is supposed to happen, I mean, if it's possible, right? Then something has to be singular on the right-hand side of that equation, either J dot B or surface terms, right? I mean, it has to, because you have...
No, wait a moment.
...zero or the one number on the left-hand side. So something better be going to infinity on the right-hand side, otherwise you can't balance this either going to zero.
But you can show, and I'll come to this in a moment.
Let me get to the end of this thing. So if the question that we addressed, and if you quote us... God damn it, address it right, is this possible if B is of order 1? That's the question. End of story. So that's the question. You've almost already said, no, it's not possible. In other words, it takes forever to change.
It takes a resistive time scale, yes. It takes a resistive...
Well, that's it. You might as well just wipe everything out and send us home. It doesn't happen.
Yeah, so that would appear to mean that the large-scale mean field dynamo can only happen on a resistive time scale.
If
everything is correct.
If B is zero, it can go as fast as you want.
Sure.
If B is zero, that formula doesn't tell you anything. It says, yeah, it can go fast. If you want, you can make it go as fast as you want. If B is of order 1, it doesn't work.
This is an equation linear in quadratic quantity. So if B is of order unity or not, that doesn't actually have to do with this effect. If you have initially, so let me just rephrase the whole issue in other words. If you start initially with a weak magnetic field, that's what we always do. You have weak magnetic energy and therefore also weak magnetic helicity. So basically, magnetic helicity is zero. Then the magnetic energy increases, and of course, according to this equation, the magnetic helicity has to stay zero. Correct.
If
there's
no.
What happens if J at some point is very large.
But that's the thing. Something better than singular here.
But nothing is going singular.
You can't control this.
How can you not go singular in the limit of eta going to zero if the left hand side is a number of
Wait a moment.
How do you do that?
Wait a moment. You can estimate this term. You can. And I'm referring to Burgers' inequality. You are familiar with Burgers' inequality. That shows you that you cannot generate magnetic helicity faster than on a resistive time scale, unless the magnetic energy blows up, which of course it doesn't.
There you go. Then you answer the question. Then you cannot.
Yeah. So nothing goes singular. You were saying something goes singular. I'm just saying it's not true. Nothing goes singular here. So singularity doesn't actually affect the issue.
It does go singular if B is sufficiently small. It's a matter of limits of our M going to infinity and B going to zero.
Are you talking about scales or field strength?
Strength. I mean, it's a limit between, the size of M. It depends on how
going
to infinity, B going to zero. You can always fix it so that's
what
works.
He said. If you consider big Reynolds number,
yeah,
then you might get bet J at some point. If you at small, at 40s, of course everything is very small and the only thing.
That is a theorem. That is a theorem that the rate at which this can change is resistive. It goes like eta to the 1/2. So, in other words, if you have, if J goes singular, of course, but in such a way that eta times J is squared, which is the rate of ohmic heating, stays constant. So that means that J would increase too slowly relative to eta. And that's the reason why they have an eta to the 1/2 term. But again, it's off the track. What I want to say, first of all, is what we have seen so far needs to be interpreted correctly. And that's I want to bring this to an end here. So the first thing is, in the simulation, what has happened? Obviously, something has happened which in principle is not possible because you have generally large-scale magnetic fields which are helical. The way how that is actually possible is that you can have this term equal, towards the end of the simulation you have a steady state, in which case, of course, all d by dt terms must vanish, and that means if the right-hand side must be zero. And that can be zero still for large field strengths if large-scale and small-scale current helicity are of opposite sign. Now, from this, first of all, you directly see a result, how strong the magnetic energy must be. The energy is related to the magnetic helicity by a wave number factor, given that the magnetic field is fully helical here. At small scales, again, there's a wave number factor relative to the small scale field, which is a small scale wave number. One thing you see here is what we have seen in the simulation before, but now you understand this quantitatively. At the end of the simulation, which is after a resistive time scale, the magnetic energy at large scales relative to the magnetic energy at small scales is in super equipartition by the factor of 5, kf divided by k1, forcing wave number divided by large scale wave number. So large scale separation clearly means after a resistive time scale you have a large scale magnetic energy, which is in super equipartition. Easy to see from this, by the way, is that if you use hyperdiffusivity, you would get the wrong result because it goes with the wave number ratio to a different power, confirmed by simulations. Now the question of how do we understand explicitly the saturation behavior? Take again the magnetic helicity equation. We have seen that towards most of the end of the simulation, magnetic and large and small scale current helicities are approximately in equal magnitude, but of opposite sign. So we can again estimate these two contributions from large and small scales in terms of their respective energies, and you get a full closed equation. For the large scale, for the magnetic helicity, it's a good approximation to only use the large scale magnetic energy, but I come to that also. So this equation you can solve, and it describes, of course, the process of a switch-on phenomenon. And that's exactly what you see here. So the curve, which you see here in the dashed line, is actually the result of this formula. So to, quantitatively and to a very high accuracy, and I come to this question of accuracy, this process is actually understood. It has to do with this, and the time scale that enters is the molecular diffusion time. So nothing singular here. But here's actually an interesting question. How long does it actually mean as far as the sun is concerned? Here comes the estimate that I wanted, that is basically due to Berger, except that it's here applied to oscillatory magnetic fields. You can estimate the rate of change of the magnetic helicity by the corresponding RMS values of the current and the magnetic field. You pull one eta to the 1/2 factor into the current term, and so you have a term which is here the joule, rate of joule heating, which I call Q. Goes Q to the 1/2, magnetic energy to the 1/2. You divide, you express basically Q in terms of a frequency times the magnetic energy. And so you have energy on the right hand side. You divide, so you get an estimate for the rate of change of the magnetic helicity divided by the magnetic energy. And the rate of change must be less or equal to this quantity. Does anybody recognize this quantity here? It's essentially a skin depth. It's essentially a skin depth. This is the Spitzer diffusivity, and this frequency, of course, corresponds to the 11-year cycle frequency. So in order now to answer the question, is the resistive time scale now long or short, we ought to find out what these values are. Eta is well known, is 10 to the 4th centimeter squared per second. Omega is 10 to the minus 8 centimeters per second, giving you a length scale of between 10 kilometers at the bottom of the convection zone up to 300 kilometers of the, at the top of the convection zone. Now the next question is, if you were able to measure in the sun by how much the magnetic helicity changes, and here I'm showing you just as an illustration, but it's a quantitative thing, how the helicity actually changes as a function of time, you see that the helicity does actually change on each hemisphere. It does even go slightly to negative values, but the main thing is it does change every 11 years. The question is, how quickly can that happen? And we see that there must be, of course, a limit on the rate at, of time, rate of change at which this can happen. Now, the value that you would, so obviously the rate of helicity cannot change by faster than is implied by this formula here. Now we work this out for a particular model. And this model is a generic model. You are welcome to check this for any other model. You find that the for a model that satisfies magnetic field strength at the pole, which is approximately 1 to 2 Gauss, and the equatorial plane anywhere between a few kilogauss and up to 10 kilogauss, you find that this H over M is only as big as 10 to the minus 6 times the solar radius. So if that's what you plug in, you find, and this number is actually wrong, it's 10 to the minus 5, and then this is 10 kilometers, I forgot to change that, or 7 kilometers actually, is at least comparable to the limit, to that maximum limit. So if you're saying it's infinitely long, then that's clearly not wrong. It's of comparable order of magnitude. So, and I think that's, first of all, remarkable. There's the resistive time scale that really comes into the play here, which is very long, but it's only as long as 11-year cycle, given the relatively small amount of by which the helicity needs to change from one cycle to the next. The reason why this number is small is because this is an estimate for the ratio of poloidal to toroidal field strengths. In the sun, the poloidal field strength is far weaker than the toroidal field strength. But let me carry on. So now, that was the end of everything I wanted to say about simulations. Now I come to mean field theory. So the first thing is we have seen that to a very good approximation, the magnetic helicity constraint equation, which has nothing to do with mean field theory, satisfies the simulation data. Next thing is, can we explain that in terms of mean field theory? If you want to do that, we can, for example, try out something with a quenching under of this form. If we do this, not only just for alpha, but also for eta, then you're actually able to reproduce the simulations. And that is this red line over here. So let me emphasize, it's one possible interpretation, and I'm emphasizing this because there are other interpretations that also fit this, but many others which again don't fit this. One possible interpretation is that not only alpha is quenched, but also eta at the same time. And that's the reason why, how you could possibly understand that a large scale, a strong large scale field is being generated. So if the generating effect is decreased, but also the resistance is decreased, then of course the final effect is not quenched, and that could be one of the reasons why a large field strength is reached. Let me emphasize once more that the fit is extremely well here. You see basically no departure between the red line and the black line here. But this is not the only interpretation. In order to see how sensitive that actually is, you can just allow yourself some very minor modifications. This formula has a certain property. You may wonder, of course, how generic is that. Take, for example, a formula which looks pretty sophisticated, but has exactly the same limiting behavior, like 1 over b squared at large field strengths, and also 1 minus b squared, which this one has, for weak field strengths. This one has the same behavior. You see already departure, so you can exclude that from the numerical data, because that is the blue curve, and the blue curve deviates from the blue circle significantly, whereas the red curve is top on the red dots. So first of all, the numerical theory, the numerical simulations are able to eliminate a large number of quenching formulas, but they do not allow us to prove that one particular one is right. And it comes now at a bit as a surprise that a number of others actually also work.
Alpha B more.
Sorry?
What is alpha B?
Alpha B is... it's basically the Reynolds number. It's basically the Reynolds number. It actually is something which I can write down precisely.
Defined in a strange way.
No. This coefficient, which I call the alpha B, which I often call A now, is exactly equal to the kinematic alpha value minus the turbulent diffusivity times the wave number of the large scale divided by the molecular eta times the wave number of the forcing. And that is an exact result for in the limit of large Reynolds numbers. So it's not exactly the Reynolds number, but it's, of course, basically like a Reynolds number, because it has an eta in the denominator and has dynamical qualities. These are the kinematic values in the denominator. So that's the value that you have to put in here, and only then it works. But now I want to come to an end. Before I do that, let me point out that there's one more way to explain what has gone on. So far we have seen that one possible interpretation to the data is that you do have and quenching of not only alpha alone, but of alpha and eta at the same time. In any case, alpha and eta get quenched to a value which is extremely small. If you now allowed, of course, for variation, like on a cycle time scale, you would still have a problem, or may have a problem, if the resulting value of alpha for large field strengths is too small, in particular eta is too small, because then the cycle frequency that you would expect would be far longer than 11 years. Now, is this the only solution to this approach? The answer is no. Take again the magnetic helicity equation. We split it again into our contributions from large and small scales. Unlike before, where I neglected the contribution from the small scales, I was saying this is indeed much smaller than this one, which is true, I actually include the temporal term here. And that is important because at early times, large and small scale magnetic helicity do, of course, cancel exactly. So at definitely early times, it's very wrong to ignore this term. They are exactly equal because of total magnetic helicity conservation. Now, in order to write down the large-scale the magnetic helicity equation, you basically start from the large-scale dynamo equation, which has this ominous term, the electromotive force in it, which we know. You derive an energy helicity, you derive an helicity equation, which is this, and the total helicity, of course, has to satisfy exactly this equation. So that means at small scales, you have a corresponding contribution from here, and the electromotive force term has to balance out exactly the corresponding term in the small scale equation. So once you satisfy this, you are automatically satisfying helicity conservation. And as far as this very sensitive test, and I showed you it was very sensitive because it eliminates a large number of quenchings, I showed you only one, is concerned, you are now bound to have satisfied magnetic helicity conservation exactly, whatever you do with this term. Now, of course, what you do with this term is you couple this to the alpha effect. The alpha effect, I told you, is a pseudoscalar. And the obvious suggestion, which has arisen from analytic theories in the past, is that the alpha effect actually is the sum of the molecular value of the kinematic value and the magnetic value. Now, the magnetic value would then be the current helicity, which is actually this term. It's not the A dot B term. Now, at least for isotropic turbulence, and as far as volume average is concerned, and only then it's really true, these two are linked by a wave number squared. So you have an equation, therefore, for J dot B, also here, because A dot B is J dot B divided by Kf to the minus 2. You have an expression which directly corresponds to an evolution equation for alpha m. You have a term, a driver term here, which includes still this eta term, but it's basically cancelled because it's this a, which is the same as alpha b over here, which is this term. The eta actually cancels out. So you have a driver term in this approach, in this theory, which must satisfy fully magnetic helicity conservation, which actually is of order unity. And then this term, again, is resistively limited. Now, of course, if you look at the stationary state, d by dt of alpha is 0, then alpha m is equal to this value. You plug this in, and what you get out of this, under the assumption, and that is still an assumption which is not fully justified yet, that eta t, in this case now, it stays unchanged. So if eta t is constant, it's not quenched at all. In that particular case, you find this equation. This equation for the in the stationary limit. And I told you already that this equation satisfies exactly what Fausto and others have found. So clearly, it is not at all in any contradiction with Fausto simulations. Furthermore, and most importantly, it's also not in contradiction with the simulations that I've done. So let's look at the difference now. You have now two different proposals for the quenching. One is this algebraic one. The other one is fully motivated by magnetic helicity conservation, more reliable in that sense. Does not need to be the final truth, however. You compare the two. First of all, if you compare with the simulation is a black line. You cannot distinguish between the two. If you now look at the difference between the simulation and algebraic quenching, you find this curve here. It's again a very small difference, only 10 divided by a tenth of divided by 5, which is 2%. Very small departure here. And for the dynamical quenching, this departure that you do see here is definitely decreased even further. So the main conclusion, first of all, is both approaches satisfy the or reproduce the simulation data reasonably well, but definitely the dynamical quenching, if anything, even better. But now the question, of course, is what happens under more realistic circumstances. Let's ask the question, first of all, what happens at the very early stages where the magnetic field grows? Here we have a mean field model, and that allows us now to go to a large magnetic Reynolds numbers, 10 to the 6 here. And we look at the differences between dynamical quenching and this Lorentzian expression, as I call it over here. One of the differences is that for small magnetic Reynolds numbers, both behave in the same way, for Reynolds number 10. For somewhat larger Reynolds numbers, at this time here, approximately, again, the same behavior. But you see already much smaller energies for the Lorentzian quenching as for the dynamical quenching. And definitely the limit of very large magnetic Reynolds numbers, this one brings you up to a certain value and then stops instantaneously, basically. And after this is a very long, infinitely long resistive time scale. Question is, what has happened here? It's very easy to understand what has happened here. Remember, we start off with full helicity cancellation. So we have positive magnetic helicity at one scale and negative magnetic helicity at another scale. They ought to be in balance all the time. And you generate very strong large-scale magnetic fields in such a way that the helicities are still the same at large and small scales. Now, magnetic helicities and wave numbers are coupled by the wave number ratio, of course. But in contrast to the final saturation value, where it's not A dot B, which is constant, but J dot B, it is coupled in the opposite direction. So here, this limiting factor is the ratio of the large-scale magnetic wave number divided by the small-scale wave number. So this is the field strength at early times, or at the time of saturation. So that's for short times, T resistive. And it's only at very large times you get actually the opposite, Kf divided by K1 at T is comparable to the resistive time scale. So this result is very easy to understand. It just means that magnetic helicity is conserved exactly all the time. And the Lorentzian quenching approach just does not reproduce that. So we have a very simple result, which at the moment we are not able to check numerically. But it physically does simply make sense because you have full Helicity conservation. And this dynamical quenching approach, as it has to do, satisfies this behavior exactly. And so you do actually predict a magnetic field strength, which is not of equipartition, it's sub-equipartition, by this ratio here, which would be 1/5. So 20% of the equipartition field strength. You are still able to do, even in the limit of infinite Reynolds number, according to this model prediction. This model would not, of course, predict this. The Lorentzian model, but the dynamical quenching model would predict this. So that means if you were to apply this to the galaxy, and there's a whole lot of other things that have to be taken into consideration, of course, before we can do that, at least that would not mean that the resistive time scale would come into a problem here, because that's the large-scale magnetic energy that you would generate in that case. So it's still 20%. Another very important implication is, what do they have to do with the cycle frequencies? Clearly, if you have a Lorentzian quenching, alpha and eta become quenched, and you get very long cycle periods, as is seen here in a model calculation. If you have dynamical quenching, you have short-type cycle frequencies. Which of the two is correct? We can only tell by doing model calculations, of which this one is one of these. We are just beginning to see cyclic behavior of the magnetic energy here, which is not so easy to see in this, but it's easier to see in a butterfly diagram. If you plot a space-time diagram, you do see in this Cartesian simulation cyclic magnetic fields, where we have strong shear, where magnetic field propagates exactly as you would predict from mean field theory. The question is, and it's still not conclusive, to which extent does actually the magnetic diffusivity come into play? Let me also emphasize, in this simulation, that has nothing again to do with theory again, it's directly the simulation, you generate large-scale magnetic fields which are cyclic, which are 50 times in super-equipartition, as far as the energy is concerned. So in the simulation, and that's not a surprise, you go even to larger values than this one here. For B relative to B equipartition, you generate very strong super-equipartition magnetic field strengths. The reason is because this had to do with the constraint from Helicity conservation. But of course, there's now shear, and shear generates you arbitrarily long string, strong fields, depending on how strong the shear is, totally independent of the Helicity constraint. And that's the reason why you can even get to larger magnetic field strength. So this is a model, a direct simulation, which allows you to generate magnetic fields as large as 50 or even larger if you want. So I think that is another important conclusion to take away from this, that the simulations which do generate large-scale magnetic fields are not limited to generating you weak magnetic fields. They can actually generate strong magnetic fields, perhaps as strong as we actually need this for the sun. To conclude now, the solar magnetic field is of large-scale field, suggesting large-scale nature, suggesting that there is a collective behavior going on. It makes it perhaps useful to try to understand that in terms of mean field approach, which describes collective behavior. But the alpha effect is, as yet, ill understood. We seem to find that it's not just a non-local inverse cascade, not just a local inverse cascade, but actually a non-local cascade. The resistive time scale comes into operation, into play here. It is something which is easily overlooked. If I take my convection simulations, for example, I find that the resistive time scale that would actually come into play here would not show up yet. So in convection calculations, it's very much harder to actually verify whatever I've said here so far. You would need to go to even larger or very large magnetic Reynolds numbers, which you cannot do at the moment. Another justification why it's actually useful to do models of simply force flows here. Large-scale fields can still be strong. They don't need to be weak. Many quenching formulae can be ruled out, except for the dynamical quenching, which at the moment still seems to be the best description. Thanks.
Question about the Helicity conservation between the large and the small scale.
Yes.
Since there's Helicity obviously being dumped out into the solar wind and magnetic flux ropes and so forth and so on, doesn't that seem to imply that the Helicity density must be continued growing indefinitely on small scales inside the
sun? Yeah. So that's, first of all, a very important question to look at. The important conclusion or important suggestion was made by Blackman and Field that maybe this loss can actually even help you in overcoming the resistive constraint. That does not seem to be the case. It would require that what we lose is actually the small-scale magnetic helicity. Even if we did lose that, it does not actually seem to solve the issue of resistively.
If what you're seeing is a small-scale helicity, yeah. Where is the large-scale helicity?
Yeah, indeed. And what actually the simulations have shown, and we have published such simulations already, is what you actually lose is large-scale helicity. And that means you're basically just having an exit on whatever you're generating. Whatever you have generated with a lot of effort, you are losing all the time. And so the dynamo has to be correspondingly more efficient in order to overcome this loss. It's basically as simple as that. There's nothing more magic going on. Now, the next question is, of course, how strong is really the loss? And this we don't really know. It is possibly not terribly large. That depends exactly on what kind of boundary conditions we have, and it probably also depends very much on the degree of stratification we have, because we know that everything that is produced in the sun is basically actually transported downwards by convection. It's not transported upwards, which would only happen to very strong magnetic fields and buoyancy. It's transported downwards. And so maybe the losses that you have are restricted only to very strongest flux tubes that are in the game, and the overall losses are maybe only a few percent, in which case quantitatively wouldn't change this issue very much. But it's very important to look at that, and I'm interested to compare that with simulations.
Sure, you have to look at our paper with Mischberger. We discuss the balance, what goes in the solar wind, and so on. In some sense, it has the answer to your question.
Yeah, so what Berger and Rosmaikin found is a loss of magnetic helicity of 10 to the 45 maxwells. And it's constrained to the large scales, mode number m equals 0. Very much weaker contributions from m equals 1 and higher. The first question to answer is, of course, is 10 to the 45 big or small? And second question is that correct or not? There are other conflicting results, which maybe are really then wrong, which go up to, which find, that is a paper by DeVore, for example, which find values up to 5 times 10 to the 49 Maxwell squared, so 5,000 times larger. So a very important question to settle, first of all, is which helicity flux is actually correct? How big is it? And if it departs that much from, if the measurements are that uncertain, it's quite possible that it's just a little bit, the thing we have to compare this is, to, of course, is the magnetic helicity content. So we have to compare the flux relative to the content in order to get a time scale. And it would be this time scale which would basically affect the time scale that I've discussed here, which is the resistive time scale. So maybe that one is actually not conflicting and almost otherwise boundary-less theory.
They're pretty hungry. I apologize for interrupting you.
And I apologize for the late start.
Okay. Well, for no other questions, we thank Axel again. Thank you.